was able to put his coat over the razor ribbon and shield himself somewhat from the razor ribbon using that.
A prisoner is caught after an early morning escape from a Matsu prison. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a court victory for homeless advocates in Anchorage.
This particular judge has ruled that we have not yet met the standard as he sees it, so we've got to review what we've done today, review the decision.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
School children in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough were kept indoors today after a prisoner escaped from the Matsu pretrial facility in Palmer. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the felon, considered dangerous by law enforcement officials, was nabbed in Wasilla early this afternoon.
How does a 6'1", 220-pound, middle-aged man escape from jail? Apparently by creating a hole in a chain-link fence and crawling through it. That's how Deputy Commissioner of Corrections Sam Edwards described the escape plan of Kent Charles Matt, a felon who fled the Matsu pretrial facility at 8:05 this morning.
Should be considered dangerous. And we would certainly not dispute that.
Edwards spoke at a hastily called press conference from the Department of Corrections Training Academy in Palmer this morning. Prisoner Matt, who climbed a second 12-foot fence topped with razor wire to complete his escape, was sought by Alaska State Troopers, who only this afternoon released the man's name and photo, but not the reasons for his incarceration. Matt was picked up shortly after the release of the photo on a Parks Highway intersection in Wasilla. Edwards says state troopers say an investigation regarding Matt is very hot. The corrections department helped with the apprehension of the escaped felon.
We know the prisoner jail population better than the troopers do, obviously. We're able to identify if there were associations within the population that might be valuable for the troopers to interview. We have possession of the whatever the inmate had there, so we can look through the room, see what might have been available that might have been used that the troopers might have interest in. We have visitation logs where family or friends have come to visit the prisoner while he was incarcerated.
Edwards says Matt was in an outdoor recreation area at about 7:30 this morning with two other prisoners when he made his breakout. No officers were monitoring the yard at the time, and Edwards says camera monitoring only was required. Matt is considered dangerous but was not housed in a maximum security area of the prison. One of the other prisoners alerted authorities to the man's escape. There was no guard tower at the facility. An early alert described the prisoner as 44 years of age with visible tattoos on both arms and either bald or with close-cropped red hair. One tattoo is described as tribal. He was wearing a yellow shirt and gray pants when he escaped. Just why the prisoner was desperate to escape is not known. Edwards says Matt had been incarcerated for 3 months and was housed according to his custody, not his felony offense. Later information indicated Matt's rap sheet included arrests for burglary, including theft of a firearm and various other charges such as controlled substance violations. Matt's jailbreak is not the first prison escape on record in Alaska, but it is the first from the Matsu pretrial facility. The facility houses 105 prisoners. At the time of the prison break, 104 prisoners were in there. Edwards says typically the facility is over capacity. Edwards says normal operations at the pretrial facility will cease for the time being, cutting visitation and recreation programs.
As far as the safety of the facilities itself, they are, in fact, under much closer security right now since we are in the middle of an immediate incident here. So I guess what we would want to say from corrections is that we are hyper-vigilant right now.
According to Borough School District spokeswoman Catherine Essery, students and staff in all 44 borough schools stayed indoors in a stay-put mode as a precaution after being alerted to the escape. That means schools operated normally, but exterior doors were locked. The Mat-Su School District's website indicates normal dismissal and after-school activities this afternoon. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A Superior Court judge has found Anchorage's municipal ordinance against illegal campsites violates the campers' rights to due process under the Constitution and Alaska law. Judge Mark Rindner's summary judgment in favor of the American Civil Liberties Union, Alaska, means the city will have to rely on existing laws, coming up with a new compromise procedure, or take its case to a higher court. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Judge Mark Rindner issued his nearly 30-page decision late Tuesday afternoon. ACLU Alaska Executive Director Jeffrey Mittman says the judge examined the municipality's law on a number of points. That included the nature of the homeless themselves, who often suffer from mental illness as well as chronic substance and chemical abuse.
The court recognized that these individuals need special protections. We shouldn't put them at a disadvantage and deny them access to the courts and deny them the opportunity to maintain their property and be able to vindicate their rights.
The municipality's ordinance, the city's third attempt to find a constitutionally acceptable law, called for at least a 5 days delay between posting an illegal campsite and property seizure, with an appeal process possibly lengthening the procedure. However, any property seized could be destroyed in 2 days following no appeal or an unsuccessful hearing attempt. Mittman said the timing and the destruction was crucial to the judge's decision.
The court, in looking at the seizure, noted that courts all around the country have wrestled with this issue and found, for instance, that if you want to immediately clear a homeless person's camp, you have to protect their property, take it into storage. What the ordinance the municipality of Anchorage wrote does is they throw everything out and destroy it. So if they're a mistake, it'd be too late. The individual's tent, their clothing, their papers, their personal belongings would all be gone, and there's nothing they could do to get them back. And that's what troubled the court.
In an afternoon press conference, Municipal Attorney Dennis Wheeler responded to the decision by saying the goal of the city was simply to clean up the camps, keep people safe, and make the public spaces available to everyone.
So we wanted to figure out what was the minimum required to meet the constitutional concerns and not build a process that was so lengthy and so time-consuming and so costly that it was prohibitive for us to be able to go out and clean as many of these camps as possible. So far, this particular judge has ruled that we have not yet met the standard as he sees it, so we've got to review what we've done to date, review the decision, and discuss amongst all the policymakers here, and especially with the mayor, about what to do next.
The two main options Wheeler cited were appealing to the Alaska Supreme Court or creating a new ordinance. Wheeler did not say on what grounds he thought the Supreme Court might overturn Judge Lindner's finding. Mittman said before the passage of the current law, the ACLU and then Assemblymember Dan Coffey had worked out a compromise ordinance, but it was never brought before the Assembly by the administration. Wheeler said that could change.
One of the options is to look at what the ACLU has proposed in the past and see whether that is a route that we would be interested in taking, and if that were the case, we'd obviously have a conversation with them.
Because of an injunction based on the possibility of the ordinance being unconstitutional, it has never been enforced. Mayor Dan Sullivan and Wheeler say the result is an increased number of illegal camps and campers, although the city still has the legal tools to investigate crimes and make arrests. Mittman says the ACLU supports those actions and even cited them in its suit. Nor, he adds, does the ACLU dispute the municipality's goal to remove illegal campers from city property. Mittman says it just wants to make certain the city observes the constitutional rights of the campers. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, swearing in Senator Murkowski.
Women rule, especially in this family.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
Two-thirds of Alaska's congressional delegation was sworn in for new terms today. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski and Congressman Don Young each took the oath of office in their respective chambers. Senator Murkowski made history by being the Senate's first successful write-in candidate in more than 50 years, a fact not lost on her supporters today. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
According to the Murkowski clan, to make history, you need your family by your side. Senator Lisa Murkowski's large and tight-knit family was on hand at her swearing-in Wednesday, traveling in a joyful pack throughout the Capitol.
We're going all the way down to the basement. Okay, we got one here. We got room.
Squish. The last time Lisa Murkowski was sworn in, the tram that shuttles people from Senate buildings to the Capitol broke down with her family inside. That didn't stop them, says sister-in-law Karen Murkowski, who remembers an image of matriarch Nancy.
A picture of my mother-in-law climbing out the window. The car was amazing, the subway. She's a trooper.
But this time around, things went smoothly. Cousin Mary Gore attributes that to Lisa's lucky bracelet, the blue rubber campaign bracelet dreamed up by her husband to help Alaskans remember how to spell her name. Murkowski pledged to keep it on until the swearing in, but Mary Gore says it may soon be replaced.
For Christmas, her husband gave her an engraved gold band that says, fill it in, write it in, Lisa Murkowski.
So now it's
classic.
Gore says at the core of support is a circle of women who are cousins and aunts of Lisa Murkowski and who are there for each other through thick and thin.
Women rule, especially in this family.
When Lisa Murkowski was sworn in by Vice President Joe Biden on the Senate floor, she was escorted by her father, Frank Murkowski, the man who served Alaska as senator for 22 years and made his most controversial move in appointing his daughter to the seat when he became governor. Lisa Murkowski's supporters and staffers gathered in a nearby room to watch on TV as she signed her name in the Senate's official oath book. Later, the vice president administered the oath individually in a ceremonial reenactment in the old Senate chambers.
And that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office upon which you're about to enter, so help you God.
I did.
Congratulations. This is a good one, guys. This is a good one.
The Murkowski clan posed for pictures with the vice president, and he held up one of the campaign t-shirts teaching voters how to spell her name with a cow and a set of skis on it. Members of the Senate swung by to offer their congratulations, like Senator John Cornyn of Texas, the head of the fundraising body for Senate Republicans, who shared a moment with Frank.
Well, Lisa, she kind of made this more exciting than any of us wanted, but it all turned out.
Just a few months ago, Cornyn was warning Murkowski she would lose her spot on the Republican leadership team if she launched a write-in bid. But Cornyn was sunnily optimistic about her spot in the Republican Party now.
Well, I think she can carve out whatever role she wants. I mean, she's very well respected, certainly among Republicans in the Senate, and she was a member of leadership. She resigned that when she ran as a write-in candidate, but I wouldn't count anything out in the future in terms of her role, either in leadership or, as a leading member of our conference.
In the midst of all the hoopla, Senator Murkowski paused to reflect on the day, a day that was far from a sure thing a few months ago.
Well, right now it feels like organizing the circus, trying to get everybody moving to the right places. So there's a lot of commotion, but centered in all of it was the very solemn moment of raising your hand and pledging to defend the Constitution in our country, and it kind of slows everything down and brings it back to where we are at this moment, which is continuing the representation for the state. It's a pretty sobering and really somewhat overwhelming responsibility, but
we're going to need more than one element.
Ready to shoulder it.
And with that, Lisa Murkowski led her family back into an elevator to head off through the Capitol again. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Congressman Don Young started his 20th term in the House of Representatives today. He was sworn in with the rest of the House members in a ceremony performed by newly elected House Speaker John Boehner of Ohio.
Faithfully discharge the duties of your office on which you are about to enter, so help you God. Congratulations.
Young supports the Republicans' first big agenda item, repealing the Democratic-led health care bill. He says there are a lot of brand new Republicans this year who plan to shake things up, but says he'll wait and see where things actually go.
I can say this is my 20th swearing in. The first one was the best. That was by myself, and I like that. Not so much of this cattle call, but there's a lot of new members that think that they will be able to rebuild Rome in a day. There's an awful lot of stones in the Roman walls, and it'll take them a long time. As long as we show we're making an effort, I hope people recognize that we will be doing that. Primarily, it'll be, I believe, again, as my motto in the election was, we have to address the regulatory laws that cost us money.
Young had a reception this evening to celebrate with staffers and friends, but this is his first time in nearly 40 years of taking office that he didn't have his wife, Lou, by his side. She died in 2009. Sitka's Sheldon Jackson College is finally out of debt, almost. Alaska Growth Capital is releasing the balance on loans made to SJC over the past decade, loans which ultimately drove the school under. While some unsecured debt remains, the way is now clear for the Sheldon Jackson trustees to transfer the historic campus to another institution. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Board President Shirley Holloway was nursing a cold when the news was announced, but she couldn't help but be relieved and grateful.
I feel like it's a red-letter day for us and for the Sitka.
Holloway is one of five remaining trustees who oversaw the demise of Alaska's oldest educational institution. Sheldon Jackson abruptly shut down in June of 2007 when it could not meet payroll. It was reportedly laboring under several million dollars of debt, much of it owed to Alaska Growth Capital. While the trustees first entertained the idea of reorganizing and reopening, and subsequently a takeover by the University of Dubuque, the focus lately has been on saving the historic core campus for use by another, any educational institution. The Sitka Fine Arts Camp is the likely institution waiting in the wings. Holloway says there's more for the trustees to do besides just handing over the keys.
We won't run away fast because there's a lot of historical things that we really want to take care of, and we want to work with a lot of different stakeholders in terms of preserving the history of the college. There's just a lot of stuff to do yet.
Hugh Short, the CEO of Alaska Growth Capital, says AGC has always had the welfare of Sheldon Jackson in mind. He says arriving at an agreement with the trustees was not difficult.
It's been our goal all along to work with the trustees to preserve the core campus and to provide a soft landing for the trustees and Sheldon Jackson.
With the recent closing of the sale of the Stratton Library to the state for $2 million and some other major pending sales, Sheldon Jackson's debt to AGC has been pared down to around $650,000. There's also another estimated $600,000 or so in unsecured debt to local vendors and other creditors from the school's last days. SJ's executive manager, John Holst, told a meeting of concerned Sitkins last fall that there was no way the trustees could clear both amounts without parceling out more of the core campus. Holst mentioned that the trustees would likely make a personal appeal to Chairman Jacob Adams and Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, the parent of AGC, and the many shareholders with ties to the college. Alaska Growth CEO Short says those ties were a factor in the decision to release the debt.
There's a long tradition of ASRC executives and elders attending the college. That's important.
Short says many in the community of Sitka and the state stepped up to the plate to purchase the college's property and infrastructure, eliminating the vast majority of our investment. I'm Robert Woolsey.
A union attempting to organize a group of University of Alaska employees isn't giving up. The Alaska State Employees Association, or ASEA, garnered the required level of interest from the 2,500 support staff group last summer and was approved by the state to go forward with a vote, but never scheduled an election. ASEA Administrator Jim Duncan says organizers felt they needed to reach more employees before moving ahead with a vote.
But that did not stop the organizing campaign. We're still proceeding. We have individuals up in Fairbanks who are working with the Fairbanks employees, staff here in Anchorage, working with employees in Anchorage, and we're also working in Juneau and elsewhere. So we are approaching it in a very, well-thought-out manner.
Duncan says it's not unusual for labor organizing campaigns to regroup. The Alaska State Troopers are looking into allegations that names were forged on union interest cards distributed by ASEA last summer. Duncan says the claim was made by an outgoing employee and there's no merit to the allegation. He says the ASEA hopes to be able to hold an election sometime this year, but that the union has to start the state approval process from scratch.
The cards that were collected and submitted with the original petition, we will not be able to use those. They become what they call stale data anyway. And once they're attached to one petition, then if you withdraw that petition, those cards are gone. So we start the card collecting campaign from ground zero. But that's okay because we're going to spend a lot of time talking to staff.
Duncan lists key issues as wages, health insurance, layoff protection, and rehire rights. UA support staff represent the only remaining unorganized group of university employees. The ASEA already represents 8,000 state and municipal employees in Alaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Help manage subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide critical advice to the Federal Subsistence Board on the management of subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing on federal public lands. The deadline to apply is February 18th. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
A Seattle-based fish processor has been slapped with a waste discharge violation by the Environmental Protection Agency. Icicle Seafoods has agreed to pay close to $6,000 in fines for Clean Water Act violations that occurred in Norton Sound in June of last year. According to the EPA compliance officer, Derek Schrull, Icicle's processing vessel, the R.M. Thornston, discharged 4,000 pounds of seafood waste processing waste into Norton Sound for 15 hours without first obtaining a National Pollutant Discharge Eliminating System permit, and that's a violation of the Clean Water Act.
We've actually reached settlement with them, and that's what the penalty of $5,920. It's been finalized now.
The incident occurred outside the three-mile limit within federal waters, which are subject to federal permits. Schrull says Icicle did self-report the incident.
I think at the time they were unaware. There was some confusion on their part.
The confusion could have come from a recent transfer of permitting authority from the EPA to the state.
Before the transfer, there was the seafood discharge permit. It was for all the waters. With the transfer, the state, has control over the state waters, and so Icicle was operating within state waters, moved to federal waters, but didn't have a permit to be discharging there. So when they became aware of that, they reported the violation to us.
Since its introduction in 1972, the NPDES permit program is responsible for significant improvements to the country's water quality. Commercial salmon trawlers have until February 25th to apply for money meant to offset a drop in king salmon catches allowed under the Pacific Salmon Treaty. Anyone who held a hand or power trawl permit in 2009 is eligible and has been sent a pre-printed application from the state's Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. The Pacific Salmon Treaty is an agreement between the U.S. and Canada on the management of salmon. When it was renegotiated in 2008, Alaska's share of the harvest was reduced by 15%. About $1.5 million was set aside to compensate Alaska trawlers for the loss. Howard Pendle has been power trolling for most of his 35 years as a fisherman. He's also on the Northern Panel that advises the Pacific Salmon Commission. He says the 15% reduction has impacts beyond the fish themselves.
That's the money they'd be spending around town. I mean, if they have a little extra, you know, able to do something with, make donations, help get kids to college and whatever. But anyway, that's really out of the net. So the thought was to try to get some of that money just directly back into their pocket.
That money starts at $75 for anyone who held a hand troll permit in 2009. For power trollers, the payment begins at $150. From there, additional money is added on for those who actually commercially harvested fish, and then again based on an individual's percentage of the total Chinook harvest from 2009. Pendle says the money will help, but he'd rather have the fish.
I don't think there's any way to compensate for the loss of fish than the fishermen have never asked for, that I'm familiar with, asked for money, and they didn't ask for it this time. We really wanted the fish.
Applications must be received by February 25th. Links are at our website, aprn.org. The Tulsaqua Chief Mine south of Atlin may soon be back in business. Its former president has teamed up with new partners to buy the old mine out of bankruptcy. As the CBC's Vic Ixchenko reports, they're hoping some high-profile new directors can help make the project viable.
Just 2 years ago, owners hoping to reopen the old gold and copper mine were $175 million in debt and on the brink of bankruptcy. The former company president, Terry Chandler, has now found new partners, and for $15 million, they now own the property debt-free. Chandler is executive vice president of the new company, Chieftain Metals. He says permitting and financing are still major hurdles, but he's counting on one of the new directors to help navigate the turbulent political landscape. He's enlisted former Assembly of First Nations chief, Phil Fontaine.
Well, obviously, Phil Fontaine brings a wealth of experience, we haven't yet had an opportunity to really advance discussions with the First Nation, but we're hoping that that will happen later this year.
The old mine has been leaking pollutants into the Tulsaqua River, and the new owners are obligated to clean up the site. Chandler says a $5 million water treatment plant will be installed as soon as possible.
It's going to be a fair amount of expense, but we hope that we could have it operational by late fall of 2011, yes.
Chandler says if all goes as planned, Chieftain Metals will be looking for construction financing the following year. Vic Ischenko, CBC News, Whitehorse.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Robert Woolsey and Ed Ronco in Sitka, and the CBC's Vic Ixchenko in Whitehorse. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com, and by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.